This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today in your health, kids with epilepsy. There are a lot of them. In the U.S. alone, more than 300,000 children have a seizure disorder. And doctors are becoming increasingly aggressive about treating those electrical storms in the brain. NPR's John Hamilton reports the change comes amid growing evidence that some seizures can cause lasting damage.
Like a lot of two-year-olds, Barton Holmes has strong opinions about things like footwear.
Red shoes.
You want to wear your red shoes?
Yeah.
Okay. Barton lives in Washington, D.C., with his dad, Kevin, his mom, Catherine, and his sister, Edie. She's four and ready for breakfast.
Edie, do you want to say the blessing before we eat? Yeah? Okay.
Oh, the Lord's been good to me, and so I thank the Lord.
Barton's breakfast will include mango coconut yogurt, some orange slices he will decide he doesn't want, a vitamin, and one very important medicine.
We also need to give you your medicine.
No,
first medicine, then vitamin, okay?
Okay. No medicine for me.
That's right. What's that medicine for, Edie, do you know?
Barton epilepsies.
Barton's epilepsy showed up one morning when he was about 16 months old. Catherine remembers that her son was crying as she left him with his new babysitter to go upstairs.
Suddenly, as I got to the top of the stairs, I realized that it was deadly quiet, that he had gone from really crying to nothing. So I turned around and started coming back down the stairs, and Carolyn, the babysitter, said, "You need to come quickly."
Catherine says it was obvious that something was very wrong with Barton.
She had him in her arms, and he was convulsing. His eyes were rolling in the back of his head, and his tongue was coming out, and his lips were blue, and I grabbed him from her, and I thought he was dying.
The seizure was over in less than a minute, and by the time an ambulance arrived, Barton was back to his old self. Even so, he was taken to Children's National Medical Center so doctors could try to figure out what had caused the seizure. They didn't find anything, and a single seizure doesn't necessarily mean epilepsy. So Barton went home.
They made an appointment for 6 weeks follow-up, but they said, if he has another one, call us. And he did have another one, and another, and another.
After the second seizure, the doctors put Barton on a drug called Keppra. And once they got the dose adjusted, his seizures stopped for several months. Then, just a couple of weeks ago, Barton had another one. So on this morning, he's headed back to Children's.
Daddy, drive?
Is Daddy going to drive to the hospital?
Yeah.
Barton, you want to get your raincoat?
No.
Barton's doctor is William Guyard, who runs the epilepsy program at Children's. Guyard says doctors take childhood seizures a lot more seriously than they did when he was in medical school.
When I was trained, the general sense was that epilepsies were not necessarily a bad thing. My fellowship at NIH changed that view very much when I saw what happened in adulthood. That was not the case.
Guyard saw that some children with prolonged or frequent seizures grew into adults who had problems with thinking and memory. And studies have confirmed that epilepsy can alter the brain. So Guyard says these days doctors tend to act quickly when they see a kid like Barton.
You want to treat the child with medications or with therapy in order to eliminate the seizures, and preferably to use a medication which is going to minimize side effects. So no seizures, no side effects is the mantra, and I think that's an appropriate one.
Guyard says that mantra has become easier to follow thanks to new treatments. For one thing, he says, drugs introduced since the early 1990s have fewer side effects. Another advance has been a resurgence in the use of low-carbohydrate diets, which seem to change brain metabolism in a way that can help reduce seizures. Then there are new implanted devices that can prevent seizures by stimulating a nerve that leads to the brain. And Guyard says parents and other caregivers can now carry an emergency kit that lets them administer a fast-acting drug to stop a seizure.
It's like carrying an insurance policy around with you. This makes it easier for families to travel. It's easier for kids to get out and about. And I think that they've gone a long way to improving quality of life, both for children and for their families.
Guyard says for some children, the most effective treatment is an old one, surgery. Surgeons can often remove a bit of brain tissue that's responsible for a child's seizures. Guyard says this approach can work if there's only one problem area and if removing it won't interfere with something like speech or memory.
Epilepsy surgery is underutilized in this country, and that is the best chance at cure if the first round or two of medications is not effective.
But for most kids, surgery isn't necessary. More than half will eventually outgrow their seizures, and in the meantime, their epilepsy can usually be controlled with drugs.
Okay, right here.
That's Dr. Guyard's goal for Barton Holmes, who is with his family getting ready for his appointment.
Is he a doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I say hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, can talk to him?
Yeah.
Barton's father, Kevin Holmes, says he's ready to try whatever it takes to stop Barton's seizures. A nurse named Audrey Scully arrives and starts gathering information.
All right, so Barton, can we have you stand on the scale, buddy?
I'm going to stand right there.
Huh?
By the time Barton leaves today, he will have a prescription for a second epilepsy drug. And the odds are good that doctors will be able to control his seizures. But for about 30% of kids with epilepsy, existing treatments don't work very well. Brandy Furiman of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke says that's probably because epilepsy is not one disease. She says there are many different epilepsies, each with its own cause. Furiman says some evidence for this comes from recent genetic studies.
People can develop epilepsy as a result of mutations in proteins that we know are very important in controlling the activity level of nerve cells. And so different mutations cause different syndromes that are epilepsies.
Still, other epilepsies may result from head injuries, a lack of oxygen at birth, tumors, and strokes. And Furiman says some of these epilepsies may require treatments that are very different from anything available now. She says one new approach, which has worked in mice, involves transplanting a type of cell that reduces excessive electrical activity in the brain.
Cell therapy may be one way that we can very specifically target the region of the brain that is overexcited and quiet that area of the brain.
Without drugs or surgery. Furiman says another experimental approach involves devices that monitor the brain for abnormal activity.
Some of these devices are actually designed to predict when the brain activity is headed towards a seizure and actually deliver stimulation that shuts down that seizure activity.
Furiman says the emphasis on preventing seizures and the activity that precedes them is a response to recent research on brain development.
The evidence suggests that even abnormal activity in the brain that doesn't lead to a seizure can still interfere with things like learning, being able to pay attention, being able to remember things.
And that's not the outcome Catherine McEady Holmes wants for her son, Barton. She says epilepsy has had a big impact on her family. Edie, the 4-year-old, worries a lot about her brother's seizures. The family has paid some big medical bills, even though they have insurance. And instead of a babysitter, they've now hired a full-time caregiver. Catherine says she knows her son's epilepsy will mean he needs extra supervision when he learns to swim. She knows he probably can't be an astronaut. But she says those are pretty minor limitations.
We have this precious child who's perfect. He has nothing wrong with his brain. And then he has these seizures that seem to be trying to mess it up. And we want to do whatever we can to make sure that we don't let the seizures stop him from having the life that we want him to have.
John Hamilton, NPR News.
On this day, 50 years ago, President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act, guaranteeing that women earn the same pay as men for work of equal value. The following year, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act banned discrimination at work. Now, half a century later, the Obama administration is pushing Congress to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, designed to make wage differences more transparent. Some dispute the frequently cited figure that women are paid only 77 cents for every dollar a man earns, but most agree that the gap becomes more significant for a woman in her childbearing years. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
In 2010, an analytics firm called Reach Advisors crunched Census Bureau numbers and found something surprising. The median salary of single, childless women under the age of 30 was 8% higher than that of their male counterparts. That's largely because more women are going to college than men. What made that number noteworthy is that it's the only group of women who have a pay advantage. In fact, different numbers from Reach Advisors notes that that early advantage vaporizes later in women's lives, especially if they have children.
studies have shown for over a decade that what is really killing women economically is motherhood.
Joan Williams is a professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law. She popularized the term maternal wall, referring to discrimination against hiring or promoting mothers based on the assumption they will be less committed to their jobs.
We run a hotline, so I hear about it most every week.
The number of pregnancy and maternity discrimination charges filed with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has steadily increased since the late 1990s. David Lopez is the agency's general counsel.
I think what's interesting is that it's against the law. I assume everybody knows it, yet it still occurs, and it occurs in a very overt fashion.
Meaning employers often leave trails of emails saying, in effect, we don't want to hire her because she's a mother. Catherine Hill is research director for the American Association of University Women. She says the pay advantage young women supposedly have disappears when you control for the level of education. Her research shows just a year out of college, women are at a 6.6% pay disadvantage. Hill says a big part of that is the anticipation of motherhood.
Am I really going to spend the money to put this woman into a training program? She's just going to leave me after all. And that kind of discriminatory behavior really boxes women in. So we all get penalized because people fear that women are going to leave the workplace.
And Hill says the pay gap compounds over time, hurting women in their retirement years. But of course, not everyone agrees there's a link between the pay gap and discrimination. Sabrina Schaefer is executive director of the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative and libertarian women's advocacy group.
I don't deny that there is a wage gap. The question for me is how big is that gap and what are the causes?
Schaefer attributes the so-called motherhood penalty in pay to choices women make to work fewer hours or take time off. Less experience adds up to less pay. And she says anti-discrimination laws paradoxically hurt working women.
I absolutely think that we would be better off without the Equal Pay Act.
Schaefer says rules and regulations make it harder for employers to grant flexible work arrangements because they're required to track pay and hours worked. So women make the trade-off to work less and get paid less, and that's not necessarily bad.
We often talk as if men and women live in a vacuum and as if what's good for my husband or what's good for me doesn't benefit the other person. At the end of the day, as I see it, our interests are tied. So I think that the idea of a motherhood penalty is a little bit outdated.
But equal pay activists say it is, in fact, the future. A recent Pew Research Center study showed 40% of moms are breadwinners and that a majority of them are single. Joan Williams, the Hastings Law professor, says the pay gap should not be framed as a matter of choice.
Women choose to have babies. They don't choose the discrimination that goes along with it.
Speaking 50 years ago, President Kennedy hailed the Equal Pay Act as a first step. He then asked Congress to fund tax breaks and daycare centers so women could remain in the workforce even after they became mothers. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
The controversy over electronic data collection at the National Security Agency comes as the NSA is putting the finishing touches on its biggest data collection center yet. As NPR's Howard Berkus reports, this data farm, costing more than $1 billion, sits on a National Guard base south of Salt Lake City.
The complex of buildings is finished, and at 1.5 million square feet, it's five times bigger than the IKEA down the road. It's top secret, so we can't get any closer than this four-lane highway. This is a location that is quintessential for Utah. Mountains rise behind this dusty desert foothill. There's even a compound of polygamists nearby. Inside the NSA's Utah Data Center, workers are now planting 100,000 square feet of computers. And sometime in September, the data harvest begins.
This is just part of a big network, okay, and that data is analyzed across that network.
Which means, says NSA Installations Director Harvey Davis, the place will employ about 100 technicians and no intelligence analysts.
When an analyst sits in front of their computer and does their work, they don't particularly care from whence the data came, okay? And as long as the data finds its way into the network, people who do the work, analytic work, and data do not have to be geographically in the same place.
So it's the computers that will do the work here in Utah, and boy, will they be busy, consuming 65 megawatts of power, enough for 65,000 homes. They'll get so hot, they need 1.5 million gallons of water a day to stay cool. After all, they'll be able to process enough emails, phone calls, text messages, and other data to take up 5 zettabytes of storage. 5 zettabytes would fill more than 1 trillion DVDs. That's an estimate from William Binney, a former NSA technical director.
They would have plenty of space with 5 zettabytes to store, you know, at least something on the order of 100 years worth of the worldwide communications, phones and emails and stuff like that, and then have plenty of space left over to do any kind of parallel processing to try to break codes.
The NSA says the data center capacity is classified information. The agency's Harvey Davis would only say this about the data it gathers.
NSA's focus is on foreign intelligence, and foreign intelligence that rides over the networks is what we're talking about.
Last summer, General Keith Alexander, the director of the NSA, was asked this during a speech at the American Enterprise Institute.
Will the Utah Data Center hold the data of American citizens?
No. Well, I can't go into all the details of the Utah Data Center. We don't hold data on U.S. citizens.
But given the revelations of the past week about NSA's data gathering, privacy activists are concerned about the agency's new data farm here in Utah. Chris Segoyan focuses on technology privacy at the American Civil Liberties Union.
We don't know everything that the NSA is doing, or in fact, most of what the NSA is doing, but there is almost certainly a surveillance that they would like to do and have not been able to do because they didn't have the storage or the computing resources to perform the searches. And this will give them the ability to do more searches through more innocent people's information.
Last month, the National Security Agency broke ground for another data farm at agency headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland. It'll be 2/3 the size of the new data center here in Utah. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
The World Health Organization says doctors everywhere should suspect a new disease called MERS when they see cases of unexplained pneumonia. The WHO issued that statement today. It says the MERS virus can spread from infected people to close contacts, including health workers. But it's not clear how people are getting infected in the first place. MERS is one of 3 deadly viruses that public health officials are watching closely. NPR's Richard Knox says any one of them could turn into a global problem and possibly a pandemic.
Today's warning about MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, comes at the end of a 6-day WHO investigation in Saudi Arabia. That's where most of the reported 55 cases of the respiratory disease have occurred. 60% of the victims have died. WHO Director General Margaret Chan called MERS her greatest global health concern when she closed the annual World Health Assembly 2 weeks ago.
We understand too little about this virus when viewed against the magnitude of its potential threat.
The past week's investigation produced no new information on how people are getting MERS, from what animal source or by what route.
That's the number one priority question right now.
That's Dr. Anthony Mounts of the WHO.
Where is it coming from and how are people getting it? If we can find that out, then it would really help a lot in knowing what's causing it to accelerate.
He says it's possible MERS could morph into another SARS, the respiratory virus that struck 8,000 people around the world in 2003 and killed nearly 800.
The lesson from SARS was that we do need to watch for that sort of thing. SARS didn't seem so transmissible under normal circumstances, but then you saw these events where it spread really crazy fast, you know, from person to person.
Officials worry about the risk that MERS may spread among pilgrims who visit holy sites in Saudi Arabia next month during Ramadan, or the millions more expected in October for the annual Hajj to Mecca. Mounts also worries that MERS could sneak out of the region in the lungs of guest workers.
Pakistan, India, Indonesia, the Philippines all have large populations in the Middle East, and travel back and forth quite a bit.
But global health specialists don't have the luxury right now of worrying about just one potential pandemic virus at a time. There's new evidence two flu viruses that came from birds are close to becoming more contagious in humans. Both are deadly among people infected so far. The H5N1 bird flu virus that emerged a decade ago is only one or two tiny mutations away from being able to easily infect cells in the human respiratory tract, according to a team at MIT. Their report is in the journal Cell. Author Ram Sessasekaran of MIT says recent samples of another bird flu virus discovered in China this spring, called H7N9, may also be getting close to spreading efficiently in humans.
Some of them are one amino acid away to achieve the necessary strength or affinity to latch onto human receptors. Then that's a key step.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health says that's important evidence.
However, that is not the entire story at all of how viruses evolve in a way to have sustained transmission.
He says what makes animal flu viruses highly contagious among people is complex and poorly understood.
In fact, I'm not even sure what the extent of the complexity is.
But he points out one possibly reassuring fact. There's never been a flu pandemic involving the kind of H5 or H7 bird viruses that are causing occasional infections and deaths among humans. But MERS comes from a family of viruses scientists understand even less than flu.
We take MERS very seriously.
He says MERS is not likely to become what he calls a doomsday virus.
But does it have the potential to evolve into something that really has a much greater impact than it's having now? Oh, absolutely.
Fauci says one thing about the current situation is certain.
I've been doing emerging infections for a very long period of time, and we usually have one on the radar screen and occasionally two. But to have three on the radar screen, at least in my experience, is pretty unique.
All over the world, from officials at WHO to scientists in labs to doctors in hospitals, it's keeping a lot of people on their toes. Richard Knox, NPR News.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
For years, high medical bills have been a leading cause of financial distress and bankruptcy in America. That pressure may be easing ever so slightly, according to a survey released this month by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Still, that survey shows 20% of Americans still face hardships because of medical costs, and the hardest hit, African Americans. NPR's Patty Naiman brings us some of their stories for our series, The View from Black America.
Mike Jackson is 52 years old. He lives in Oklahoma City and works for a major insurance company.
I have high blood pressure, hypertension, and I also have diabetes. I've been a diabetic now for 15 years.
Treating these chronic health problems isn't cheap. Jackson's bills add up to nearly $500 a month.
Diabetes alone, just the two medications alone for diabetes, would have run $325 a month.
Would have, because Jackson couldn't pay. This time last year, he was laid off, got divorced, and lost his health benefits. He worried he may not be able to afford the insulin needed to control his diabetes, so he started reducing what he took to try to make it last.
So instead of taking 60 units twice a day, I was taking 30 units twice a day. And the idea behind that was if I watch what I would eat and then stay with the 30 units, I would keep my blood sugar down enough that hopefully it would not, you know, be much of a problem.
We heard similar concerns about the cost of prescription drugs from African Americans in a poll NPR recently conducted with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard School of Public Health. One in four African Americans said they had problems paying for needed medications over the past year. For Jackson, 8 months of inadequate insulin had consequences. He developed numbness in his foot and toes and nerve damage in his eye, both complications of uncontrolled diabetes.
My left eye actually shut. It wouldn't open. The muscle for the eyelid won't open.
An ophthalmologist gave Jackson a discount, but he's still struggling to make payments. In our poll, 1 in 3 African Americans said they, too, had serious problems paying for doctor or hospital bills in the past year. To find out more about what effect this might be having on people's health, NPR put out a call on Facebook. 30-year-old Ashley Liggins responded. She lives in Fort Worth, Texas, and works full-time in finance, a job with benefits. But she says she'll never forget not having health insurance and the hard choices she had to make.
At the end of the day, it was either put gas in the car for my very expensive commute or go to the doctor. So I kind of always had to make that very critical decision. And at the end of the day, I needed a job in order to get the benefits, so the job always won out.
Liggins has high blood pressure. It runs in her family. She also tried to stretch out her medication.
Maybe skip a couple days, skip a day here, skip a day there, only drink water, watch what I eat, like, excessively so that I'm not, like, running on my pressure. If I did eat a little crazy one day, take the medicine that day.
For Liggins, too, there were health consequences. She got headaches, just didn't feel well, and when she took her blood pressure, she says, it was really high. A single mother of two young children also wrote to us. She told us about being sued by 3 collection agencies for unpaid medical bills, about $5,000. She has no idea how she'll pay. She also has high blood pressure, a common worry among African Americans in our poll. Robert Blendon is a professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health.
Here we specifically asked African American families what were the top concerns they had for health in their own family. And we ended up with high blood pressure, stroke, and diabetes as being the top. And in other national surveys, cancer and other type of illnesses are often raised as the national concerns.
And even though most of those polled actually had health insurance, either private or public, nearly half said they still worried that if they suffered a major illness in the future, they wouldn't be able to pay for medical care.
We found this general economic insecurity among families who generally were doing well, and the fear of paying a larger medical bill was just one of the top problems they had. And clearly that is in people's lives as something that really worries them on a day-to-day basis.
For Mike Jackson, a day doesn't pass when he doesn't think about what could happen.
It's one of those things where, you know, if something happens to my car or if something happens to me health-wise, I'm in trouble. If I have to go to the hospital like I did for my eye, it's one of those things if I slip, if there's any slippage anywhere, something goes wrong, I'm one step away from disaster.
So every day, more often than once, Jackson checks the internet and newspapers, searching for a permanent job with benefits. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block.
Mountains rough this time of year. Close the highway down. They don't want.
A few things to know about singer and songwriter Jason Isbell. The round softness of his speech comes from his roots in rural Alabama. He has lyrics from a Bob Dylan song inked on his forearm. He got his musical start with Drive-By Truckers, the hard-charging alt-country southern rock band. And during those years, Jason Isbell was drunk on stage pretty much every time.
I had it timed where by the very end of the show, I'd done just about all I could do standing up, you know. I knew I needed 2 or 3 before I went on. And then during the show, we'd just pass a bottle around between the band.
How much do you think you'd drink during a show?
Close to a fifth, probably.
Oh, what were you drinking?
Jack Daniels. Yep.
Jason Isbell says his drinking brought him close to the point of no return. But he's sober now at age 34 and newly giddily married to singer-songwriter and fiddler Amanda Shires. We hear them together on this song from Jason's new solo album.
And I've grown tired of traveling alone. Tired of traveling alone. I've grown tired of traveling alone. Won't you ride with me?
I visited with Jason Isbell at his home on the fringe of Nashville. He and Amanda sitting close on the couch, finishing each other's thoughts. When they're each writing songs, they have a deal. They'll separate, go into different rooms of the house, and force themselves to complete a song apiece.
For me, the important part was we can't do anything together until we finish this.
And there's no cheating. You have to write a whole song.
Now we can go back and edit later for as long as we need to. But if you don't come down with a whole song, something with verses and choruses, then you have to finish it.
So when you would come out at the end of the day and show each other what you had and play it and sing it, what did you end up with? Was there anything that you kept that you think
I used a lot of them.
Yeah, I think three made it on my record, I guess.
Probably four or five on mine. Cover Me Up was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hard one for me to even get through without breaking down the first time. Because that one is really personal, you know.
So girl, leave your boots by the bed. We ain't leaving this room. Someone needs medical help for the magnolia. It's cold in this house and I ain't going out to chop. Cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good.
It's not easy to sit down and open yourself up and say, this is how much I love you, you know. It's scary to do that.
And after having to draw that out of yourself, you know.
Yeah, it's visceral. You kind of have to reach in there and pull stuff out.
Put your faith to the test when I tore off your dress. I sobered up and I swore off that stuff forever this time. The old lover's sea, I thought it'd be me who helped him get home. But home was a dream, one I'd never seen till you.
You've been really public in talking about being sober. How long has it been?
A year and 5 months and about 3 days.
And what led up to that decision to get sober?
A lot of hard nights, you know, a lot of exhaustion, a lot of my mind sort of turning in on itself, telling me that I needed to, that it was time. And I would usually drunkenly tell her that I needed to go to rehab. And I only got to do that twice, I think. The second time, she said...
telling the wrong person.
Yeah, that was it. You're telling the wrong person. If you say this again, then you're going to be held to it. And sure enough, I said it again. And then, you know, the plans were made. She called a few people that I respect. And
that wasn't easy to do either, to call people
that
I don't
know.
That
seems like a hard thing.
You know,
really
and
does.
Say something like...
Because we hadn't been together very long, you know. She's like calling my mom and my manager and my friends.
I didn't care if he was mad at me. I didn't care if that meant that it was the end of our relationship. To me, it was, this person needs help.
Yeah, and then I went away to class for a couple of weeks. And then as soon as I got out, we flew to New Zealand. First to Australia and then on to New Zealand. So then my first show sober was in Perth in this big concert hall, beautiful place with a couple thousand people. And I'm out there with a guitar by myself. It just overwhelmed me to play a show sober. I'd done one other show sober that I could recall in 10 years. It was terrifying to go up there with the whole bright world staring you in the face.
I want to ask you about the first lines of the song, Live Oak. What are the lines, first of all?
There's a man who walks beside me. He's who I used to be, and I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me.
And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living now?
That one started as a worry that I had when I cleaned my life up and decided to be a grown-up, you know. I worried about what parts of me would go along with the bad parts. Because it's not cut and dry. It's not like you make the right decision and everything's great and you're a better person for it. You are, you know, at least 51% better. But there are some things that are lost forever. And that's just a fact of it. You know, everything's not better.
All the things that she'd suspected, I'd expected her to fear, was the truth that drew her to me when I landed here. There's a man who walks beside me, he's who I used to be. And I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living now?
I was concerned with that, and I was concerned with my relationship, not only with my wife, but with a lot of people who in some way had been attracted to me or, you know, charmed by me or just liked me in general. I was thinking, well, what are they like? You know, do they like that guy? Do they like, what combination of those two guys are going to make those folks stay in my life? Luckily, most of the people that I really cared about were there for me. And I think at the core, I still have the same values. I just actually behave according to those values now a lot more.
10 years ago, I might thought I didn't have the right to say the things an outlaw wouldn't say, but those were different days.
Well, Jason Isbell, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jason Isbell with his wife, Amanda Shires. His new album is titled Southeastern. You're listening to All Things Considered.